Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Well, it's that moment we've all been waiting for, at least since a little over a year ago when we thought the financial meltdown was maybe one of the seven signs of the apocalypse. And now that we've survived, we'll fix the problems, right? Well, we'll see. So far, it looks like an instant replay of the battle over health care reform. The jargon has changed, but the dynamics remain startlingly the same. Joining us today to give us his take on the politics and the proposed legislation itself is Andy Kroll of Mother Jones Magazine. You might remember him, Buckeye Land. Just a few years back, he was the student journalist who shined the light on the bowl game perks practice at the University of Michigan. Andy, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
Appreciate it. I guess I felt the same way about healthcare reform, but I thought everyone wanted to reform the financial sector.
Yeah, that was the state of play, like, you know, a year ago, just like you said. But forces, you know, working here on both sides of the aisle have managed to turn this into, you know, almost as bitter a divisive debate as, you know, healthcare was. And it's shaping up, yeah. I mean, you know, as you said, you know, people did have a consensus, and, you know, this was something everyone was supposed to be able to agree on, but we're losing that agreement, I think.
And as with the health care, there is a House bill that's been passed, but everything, again, seems to hinge on the Senate.
It does. I mean, like you said, it's a replay. We're seeing this health care battle play out again. Now, on the Senate side, I'm hopeful that nothing could be as ugly as at least the final days of the healthcare debate. But, you know, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell and some of his crew seem to be doing their best to replicate what we saw last month.
You know, except for a few exceptions, it seems like what we keep hearing now in just the last week or so, that Republicans are going to vote against any version that comes out of committee in the Senate. Why not? What are Democrats saying about just pushing it through?
Well, that's something that they're openly contemplating. Harry Reid last week said, you know, the time for debate is over. The time for discussion and negotiating and haggling it out is done. You know, we're going to take this thing to the floor, and we're going to try to get, the last bit of debate and discussion this week. So Harry Reid basically said, yeah, we're going to press on. Now, I think some in his own party have questioned the wisdom of that. You know, are you going to alienate other members of the Senate? Are you going to anger people and, you know, the public who thinks that Democrats are just pulling another health care maneuver? But I mean, I think Harry Reid would echo that same thing, that Republicans are just standing in the way, so why even bother?
If you're just joining us, my guest is Andy Kroll. He's an investigative reporter for Mother Jones Magazine. He covers this issue, financial reform, in Washington right now. All that said, it looks like whatever they, even if they did, quote unquote, push something through this week, it would be but a shadow of its former self. What happened to Senate Banking Committee Chair and sponsor Chris Dodd? He said he's going to retire after this term. Folks thought that would give him more courage or something. But the legislation that popped up in the last couple of weeks was appeared anything but courageous.
Yeah, well, it's a matter. I mean, this debate, especially, you know, with Chris Dodd, it started last
mm-hmm.
summer.
Yeah,
the hearings, and the administration put out its plan, and the Senate got to work on its own. And what you saw, inevitably, as what happens with every bill, is it got weaker and weaker with each draft that we saw. Now, there are parts of it now that the experts say would accomplish significant reform. I think we saw President Obama last week take a pretty tough stand on derivatives, which, you know, these tricky products
mm-hmm.
that, you know, both are useful but can be used as, you know, risky, earth-shattering casino chips. And the president said, you know, I'll veto any bill that doesn't have derivatives, tough derivatives reform. So there are some bright spots. But, you know, if you look at the November draft that Senator Dodd's
mm-hmm.
committee put out, and then the one that they put out earlier this winter, it's obvious that everything has been weakened. There is no bill that gets stronger as it works its way through the machine.
That's true. But one of the things that's taken a hit that's, I think, the most noticeable is where the a supposed consumer financial protection agency would be housed. And the whole idea of that originally was to have it independent so that it could oversee operations in these other agencies, federal agencies, and how they work, as well as the financial sector. But now they're talking about putting it in under the auspices of the Federal Reserve.
Right. And the agency was envisioned, and I think it's staunchest defenders, consumer advocate, expert, congressional watchdog Elizabeth Warren, they wanted it to stand alone and be independent, which would mean it would look something like the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, which would have been great. But that, the political support evidently is just not there. And so the suggestion now is to house it within the Fed. Now, within the Fed, it would have its own budget. It would have.
It would be separately approved budget.
They're saying it would. Yes, it would be separately approved. The Federal Reserve could not meddle or whittle away at it. It would essentially share an address, but would not have any sort of. You wouldn't report to the Fed. The Fed couldn't influence at all. But the problem that is worrying a lot of people who support the agency. Not only is the appearance of it being in the Fed, but the fact that the teeth of the agency, the enforcement power, the people who not only write the rules but go out there and make sure people are complying with them, that has been whittled down as well. Now it's subject to there's a check and balance and this group of regulators that's part of the bill would be able to push back against the agency. And I think that has people worried, because what good is the thing if it can say hey, mortgage lenders, you need to ban these products, you need to do this, you need to do that. But no one's out there enforcing it. There's no cops on the beat. They're just people saying, do this, do that. But if you don't, there's nothing we can do about it.
It sounds like more of the same. It sounds like exactly what the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan, and then Ben Bernanke were saying is, yeah, there are these rules, these vague rules out there we're supposed to enforce, but they're too vague to enforce.
Yeah, that's a huge problem. And that's what this agency would be set up to look like if we really, water down and blunt, its enforcement power. But it's hard to see that getting any better because, right, like you said, there's only opposition right now. So it's unclear how the agency is going to turn out, whether it'll have that teeth or not.
You talk about lobbying and everything, and really where the lobbyists are coming from are the financial services sector, the non-commercial banking industry. These were the very entities that were demonized by their own accord. A little over a year ago. What happened? How can they have this much clout when they're part of the problem?
They have all the money. That's what our political blogger here at Mother Jones, Kevin Drum.
Right.
It's a simple answer, but I think it largely gets to the heart of the problem is, the financial services sector. If you look at the growth of that compared to most other sectors, it's been exponential in the recent decades. And the fact is they have all the money. And with all that money, they can buy as many, the influence of politicians through lobbyists, through, the dangling campaign donations. There's been an interesting shift, traditionally, or at least, in the past couple of decades, Wall Street has given a lot to Democrats, the majority to Democrats. But now that Democrats have cast themselves as reformers, Wall Street is now saying, well, maybe we should shift our funding to the GOP. Recently we saw Mitch McConnell and John Cornyn go up to who's a top Republican senator, go to Wall Street and meet with a bunch of hedge fund types. And it's clear that Wall Street is going to support the people who are in their best interests. And they're going to dangle that campaign money over those people's heads, and that's how they get what they want. They have such deep pockets that they can spend freely to get what they want.
It sounds like when you hear about the Senate Finance Committee. That's not exactly what it's called, but the committee that did Senator Dodd. Chairs, you hear about how powerful it is, and it's really not about we get to make these rules that cover these powerful institutions. It's really about the money that they can generate from for their campaign war chests.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And Senator Dodd has traditionally been, I mean, he's from Connecticut. You know, Connecticut is a huge home for hedge funds, you know, big players in the mm-hmm. financial services, big investors. And, you know, he has always been a very large recipient of money from big finance. And you know, the fact of the matter is they have small armies here on the Hill, you know, every day going out and pushing their message. And, you know, the American Bankers Association brings their people to Washington, and they're on the Hill. And when they have that much money, and when they have that many people, lobbyists at their disposal, you know, it's their message that gets through the clearest, or their money that gets through the clearest, or both.
You know, I can't remember if it was Kevin Drum, your colleague, or maybe another. I don't think it was you that wrote about how Americans, even though they hate it, they're afraid to monkey too much with Wall Street.
Yeah, that was our bureau chief, David Corn.
Okay.
He wrote about that, and it was right alongside a good piece that Kevin did on big finance and lobbying. Yeah, I think that a huge part of that is the complexity of what we're talking about. I mean, you know, you say derivatives, and I think people's eyes glaze over, unfortunately, because, you know, derivatives, as opaque as they and complex as they seem, they have an impact on your average person who is a 401k, or, you know, who doesn't even care about investing. It still impacts everyone. And I think, whereas you can, healthcare, though incredibly complex in its own right, can be summarized and can be simplified for people, some of these financial products and these financial, you know, it's like the shadow banking market, it's very hard to put in plain English. And people aren't necessarily attracted or interested or can't get as riled up as we would think about stuff like that. Now, when we're talking about bonuses, you know, when AIG had that huge bailout and then mm-hmm. gave out, you know, more than $100 million in bonuses, that got people fired up. But that isn't the whole issue. And those things only pop up, you know, every so often. Now, we're seeing the Goldman lawsuit right now, mm-hmm. which could very well get people fired up. But then again, you're talking about credit default swaps and these other complex, tricky products. And it's hard to you know, raise the public ire behind something like that.
I want to get back to the Goldman lawsuit and some other issues when we return. This is my guest is Andy Kroll. He's an investigative reporter for Mother Jones Magazine. He operates out of Washington, where he covers Congress and the issue of financial reform right now. If you have a question or comment, you have your own experience, you know, something that you're particularly interested when it comes to financial reform, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Go for rich conversation on the topics that matter most. The radio is more responsive than the water cooler, and we take your calls. I'm Neil Conan. If you're talking about it, we're talking about it. Join us for provocative talk on the issues you really care about. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And Talk of the Nation begins this afternoon at 2 o'clock right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. 50 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:20 this morning. Sunshine this afternoon, a high right around 62. A few clouds tonight and a low of 40.
Support for WOSU comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about The hot topic in Washington now, which is financial reform or financial regulation reform. My guest is Andy Kroll. He's an investigative reporter with Mother Jones Magazine. Andy, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
I wanted to talk a little bit more about the Goldman lawsuit and a story today in the New York Times and the caucus. They talk about how the lawsuit filed against Goldman could help Democrats get some Republican support for the measure. How does that work?
Well, I think what they're referring to is just that, you know, there's this issue about what, you know, Goldman allegedly, you know, creating a product and asking someone who wanted to bet against this very product to create it for them. You know, it raises these issues of, you know, Wall Street basically setting up its own investors to fail. And, you know, it's an example of, you know, an issue that could be in need of reforming. You know, do we need to have better disclosure, or do we need to kind of ban this practice outright of, you know, allowing a big company to create something that it just wants to bet against and profit off of? And then there's also some general public anger issues. You know, people will get angry when they read the bare outlines of this. You know, maybe that'll give some momentum to the Democrats who support reform.
And more of an imperative to the Republicans that want to oppose it.
True. Yeah, true.
Regarding the Consumer Financial Protection Agency, I read that Representative Barney Frank, he's the chair of the House committee and ushered through the House version of the financial reform bill. He says it's a deal breaker if they don't have that consumer protection. Now, have the things that you mentioned earlier, the fact that they're housed with the feds but they're not controlled by them financially, have those things appeased people like Barney Frank?
Well, I think Barney Frank, I think he wants to see an agency, from what I've spoken with him and what he said in other statements and hearings and so on, he wants to see an agency that's autonomous. Independent mm-hmm. is the key, which means so it is housed in the Fed, as long as it is not influenced by, say, the Fed, or whether it's put in the Treasury and it's not influenced by them. You know, it has its own budget, has its own, you know, like, presidentially appointed director, and it's basically, you know, it shares an address, as they say, but has no connection, essentially, other than, you know, using the office space that this other agency or this other organization like the Fed does. I think Frank would be willing to compromise on whether it's standalone or not, but independence is the key, autonomy is the key, and that's something I don't think he definitely won't compromise on. Because this is something that he, you know, I think he supports, you know, like you said, to a very large degree, and it's a deal breaker for him.
The Dodd bill adds a new member to the Fed's Board of Governors to recommend how the central bank does its job. Why can't Congress just decide how the central bank should do its job? Why do they need another member to the Board of Directors or the Board of Governors?
Right. Well, this gets into the, a very tricky issue about, you know, we don't want political influence in determining monetary policy. You know, if we do that, you know, does it sully how the U.S. sets interest rates and how the board operates? You know, I think that there is a movement in Congress, if not to influence it, to audit it, but to audit the Fed, which we've seen more transparency. But I think, you know, the defenders of the Fed, staunch defenders, say that they don't want any kind of political tampering, even though, you know, the federal chairman himself is a political person, a political figure. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they fear that Congress, you know, the bickering we see in Congress over other issues could bleed into the Fed, and that could have huge ramifications.
Last week, you and I were talking earlier off the air that Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell and others started the hue and cry over the how the bill would create an endless taxpayer-funded bailout of financial institutions. What is he talking about?
He's talking...
I mean, is it really there or...
No, it's not really there. This is something I'm happy to debunk. The claim that the bill would create endless taxpayer bailouts is not true. It's that is a talking point that was created by a right-wing strategist, a guy named Frank Luntz, that was basically created to say, hey, this may not be true, but it'll definitely get people riled up. And it's a very fast way to to push buttons and get people to oppose this bill. But it's not true. And the thing in question here is what's called resolution fund.
Okay.
What that basically would do is it would tax banks. It would make them pay into this fund, and the fund would reach about $50 billion. And then if a bank failed, that money would be used to, you know, maybe pay off depositors or pay off whoever needs to be paid off in that wind down or in that euthanization, as they call it. And the bank basically pays for its own failure instead of American taxpayers paying for its failure. And that's what the bill says now. It's very clear about that. You know, a Republican Senator Bob Corker was one of the people to help craft that.
Mm-hmm.
So then for Mitch McConnell to then say, hey, you know, this is endless taxpayer bailouts, I mean, he's blatantly contradicting people in his own party.
And it wouldn't necessarily bail out the institution. It would just make good on the vested interests of the depositors.
Yeah.
Why doesn't the FDIC do that? Why do they need this new resolution fund?
That's a good question, because people have asked that very thing, you know, because the FDIC does it now with smaller banks, and we've seen hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of bank failures. You know, the FDIC would have a role. The only thing the reason that the FDIC isn't just mainly put in charge is because winding down those huge banks would be a major strain on the FDIC's funding,
okay.
The FDIC's you know, its budget and what it has, the money it has to do these wind downs. I mean, the banks that we've seen now, you know, these are very large. They're the banks that have failed so far on the FDIC's list. They are large banks, but they're not necessarily, you know, the huge heavyweights that we saw, you know, the banks who came to the brink of collapse. So I think this money would not only – it would come from banks themselves. So the big banks would be funding their own failure, you know, their own – the process of taking them down if they failed. But also the FDIC would have a role, just not, you know, the brunt of paying for that wouldn't fall on them.
It's easy to see why the big banks oppose something like this. They would have to spend money on it. Is there any concern by the big bank people about public opinion at this point, or is that pretty much dissolved and they're just down to brass tacks in the Congress at this point?
Well, no, I think there is. I think that they are very cognizant. The banks are cognizant of public opinion. I mean, Goldman Sachs went so far as to hire Public Strategies, a PR firm, mm-hmm. basically, run by a former Bush, George W. Bush era. I think he was an advisor or some connection to Bush, to try to repair his public image. I mean, Goldman has kind of become the whipping boy of the financial services industry. And that was before the lawsuit stuff, too.
That's because they survived.
Yeah, exactly. So I think they are. I do think they are cognizant of that, and they are in some degree worried. But, I mean, their profits are also back through the roof, you know, that we saw this week. I mean, Citigroup is up. J.P. Morgan, you know, they recorded billions in profits. So, yeah, I mean, they probably have a little bit of worry about how they look to the public, but, you know, to their shareholders, and they're doing just fine, I think. In fact, they're doing great.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820, and my guest is Andy Kroll. He's an investigative reporter for Mother Jones Magazine. He operates out of Washington, D.C., where he covers Congress. We're talking about financial regulation reform. If you have a question, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. What do you think should be regulated when it comes to those big banks that almost, and some of them did go under, and the ones that almost went under and were bailed out? How do you think we should handle things like that? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. Andy, last week you wrote that there are five fights to watch in mm-hmm. the financial regulatory reform, and I wanted to go through those, and I thought we could start with a couple that we've already brought up a little bit. One of them is the derivatives reform. The idea is to drive that process, that trading process for derivatives, out of the dark. So the old sunshine is the best disinfected idea.
Of course, exactly. Yeah, I mean, this $450 trillion, what's called over-the-counter derivatives trading. Over-the-counter basically means the way you make a deal is you call up your guy at Morgan Stanley or Goldman Sachs, and you ask them, you know, for you want to make this kind of X kind of deal, they'll tell you. You tell them how much you want to pay. They'll tell you how much they want to charge you, and you work out a deal like that. There's no public information about that deal, how much it costs, what you know the composition of it, mm-hmm. you know the volume. Mm-hmm. These important parts of a trade are basically just conducted in the dark. Whereas you know you can see the New York Stock Exchange and you know stock trades and stock prices are public and transparent. And I think what reformers want to do, what the president wants, what the Treasury Department wants, is that transparency. They want to have an exchange trading, which basically means you can see trades, you can see how much you know your competitor is paying, and thus that helps you. You can see how much everyone else is paying, what they're paying for, and so that's a big step. And then what's also part of the bill is something called exchange clearing, which put simply would mean that if you want to be part of this trading, if you want to be in this market, you've got to be willing to absorb losses. You're part of like a group, and if you know the market crashes, all those losses are spread out amongst a number of people. Whereas right now, as we saw, say with AIG, when everything turned south, one firm in particular took huge losses, mm-hmm. and almost AIG was too big to fail, mm-hmm. and almost brought the whole ship down with it. Whereas if we have this clearing process, everyone is agreeing, hey, if we're going to participate in this, we're agreeing that, you know, if the market tanks, we're all going to bear some of those losses, and we're all going to, you know, pitch in, essentially. And that you know, spreads out losses and makes everything a little safer instead of this crazy in the dark market we have now.
Is that one of the other five issues, which would be the risk retention? Is that what you're talking about there or no?
That's derivatives. Risk retention. Risk retention is a little bit different. That is with mortgages, and that's a good one as well, because you know what we saw with, you know, Countrywide, for instance. You know, these names are familiar. Countrywide, Long Beach Mortgage, New Century, and so on. Is that, you know, they were churning out these horrible, horrible loans, things like option arms or, you know, you didn't have, or stated income, which basically means you told someone how much you made and they didn't check it or verify it. They were churning out these horrible, horrible loans and getting paid to do so. But the problem was they weren't keeping any of those loans on their books. They were shuffling these loans on, you know, to Wall Street to be packaged up and sold as bonds. And so, you know, Countrywide didn't really care whether their loans were ticking time bombs waiting to explode, because the risk wasn't on them. They originated it and passed it along. What risk retention would do was it would force you to keep a slice of the risk of all those loans. And by doing that, you have some skin in the game. And thus, if your terrible loans go bad, you're going to bear the losses too. And then in the hope is that will prevent people from just thinking that they can churn out this garbage and just shuffle it on to the next guy and have no responsibility for their actual product.
Senator Bob Corker, you've mentioned him before. He's a key GOP member of the Banking Committee. It says that, I don't know if you wrote it or not, but that he's worried about it, that it forces securitizers to retain a portion of the risk, could eat up the money on their books. Why should we care about that?
Well,
or unless you're one of the people that's working the books, we shouldn't.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, to me, Senator Corker's claim that it's, you know, it impairs liquidity. If you cover this beat for long enough, or even not long at all, you cover it for a couple months, you realize that impairs liquidity is kind of one of those empty phrases that doesn't, you're not really quite sure what it means, or even when it does, you do know what it means. People just kind of throw it out there as sort of a vague warning, you know, something you don't like what something's going to do, but you're not sure why. You say, oh, it's going to impair liquidity. And I think Senator Corker was basically saying maybe if these lenders have to keep the risk, then they have to hold on, so they have to hoard more money to, in case those risks, you know, that, you know, those losses actually happen. I don't really see how that's a bad thing, because yeah, I mean, you need to keep money if you think these losses are going to happen. But you know, if you're confident in your loans, then you don't really have to hold on to this money, and there's no problem. So, I mean, I didn't really put much weight into that reaction to risk retention, to be honest.
And back to derivative reform very quickly. You said earlier that it said Obama has said, the president said he will veto any bill that doesn't include derivative reform. Do you think he's going to stick to that, or is there enough opposition that it could become a bone of contention?
I think he'll stick to it.
Okay.
I think he will. I think that that's something that, for whatever reason, he's struck a tough stance on. We saw the chairwoman of the Senate Agricultural Committee, Blanche Lincoln, come out with her own version of derivatives reform, and she can do that because, you know, big ag uses derivatives to hedge risk. They use it as their normal business process. But she came out with a really tough bill. And, you know, there were rumblings that the White House had put some pressure on her to do that. She denied it. But I think there's, with the president's veto threat and with Senator Lincoln's very too tough to fail bill, I think that there's some momentum to actually get something done, to get something substantial and important done on derivatives right now. Whether that momentum fades, it's too early to tell. I can't predict that, but it looks good right now.
Is it with derivative reform or risk retention? Obviously, I'm having a hard time separating the two, but that there would be exemptions and that there could be so many exemptions or loopholes that it would be rendered pretty much useless?
Well, I think that in a way that applies to both of them.
Okay.
To be honest, with derivatives, that was the fear. And some people who are very staunch proponents of derivatives reform said that about Barney Frank's bill. That, you know, there's so many loopholes that it ate the rule, in a sense. And, yeah, those loopholes, the catch there was there are a number of corporations or companies that use derivatives to hedge risk. You know, for instance, if you're an airline, you don't want to have your budget impacted by the rising and falling cost of oil, which, you know, impacts airline fuel. What you'll do is you'll hedge your risk in such a way that it'll create a fairly consistent line on oil prices, and then you can budget appropriately. You can predict and count on this price of oil, whether that's the case or not, because you've hedged. They wanted to create, those are called end users, they wanted to create exemptions for them. But the problem was that exemption, as it was written in the House bill, ultimately opened the way for people who aren't mm-hmm. airlines or public utility companies or farmers. You know, it opened the door for people who just use derivatives to gamble, essentially, to make bets on the economy or in the markets. And the hope is that won't get into the Senate bill, and that with the president's threat, that will make it into the, you know, when the two bills come together. But that remains to be seen. And with risk retention, it's the same thing. You know, there are some mortgage lenders who say, hey, we didn't have terrible loans in 2003 through 2007, you know, so why should we have to keep this risk? And now there's language in the bill saying, you know, certain people who meet these guidelines, underwriting guidelines, are exempt from this rule, you know, and that could very well become a small loophole that ultimately blows up into, you know, a huge gaping hole.
Mm-hmm.
So that remains to be seen at this point.
Okay, we're going to have to take another short break, and when we return, we'll get to those calls. I see them. We will get to them. If you want to call and talk to us, 614-292-8513, or you can always email allsides@wosu.org. My guest is Andy Kroll. He's an investigative reporter for Mother Jones Magazine. If you want to talk to him, give us a call. Email us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Thursday night at 8 p.m. on WOSU TV. Tune in for WOSU's special culinary event, Chefs in the City. Now in its fourth year, this year's gourmet food experience features PBS celebrity master chef Rick Bayless and several other local chefs who share their cooking tips and tricks and prepare mouth-watering recipes. Be sure to watch Chefs in the City on WOSU-TV this Thursday night at 8.
You're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News, and in just about 20 minutes, Hour 2 of All Sides will be here. The U.S. leads the world in the number of inmates in prison or jail. A majority of those prisoners are African American or Hispanic. We'll hear why Ohio State University Moritz College of Law professor Michelle Alexander says mass incarceration in the U.S. has become the, quote, new Jim Crow. That discussion begins at 11, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from The Other Paper, Columbus's news and entertainment weekly, on newsstands every Thursday and online at theotherpaper.com.
51 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today, a high of 62, and a few clouds tonight, a low of 40 degrees, sunshine for Tuesday, and a high of 65. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking about financial regulation reform with reporter Andy Kroll from Mother Jones Magazine. Andy covers Congress in Washington. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Al, you're on the air. Thanks for waiting. Hi, Al.
Yes. I want to talk about the competency of the actual investigators. There was a one-hour interview last night of a man by the name of Markopoulos who did the investigation of Bernie Madoff. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, he wrote the book, No One Would Listen. And he said that the weakness is going to be that the current investigators and those that we will be hiring are not competent. He said they don't understand the market. A lot of them are just attorneys that don't understand the market. And he said these people, we ought to hire good people, and they ought to be rewarded. In other words, he suggested a bonus whenever they uncovered some fraudulent activity.
The point had been made many times that the folks that were supposed to be covering Bernie Madoff were sometimes hired away by him and his people.
Well, and the thing he said is we ought to have a system. Where we hire people that are competent and that we reward them.
Andy, has anything like that been brought up yet?
No, not really. And I think the question gets really at a root problem with this bill, which is, and this is something I've talked about with a number of people who are watching it and who closely follow financial reform, is that, yes, the bill, you know, moves around, you know, reorganizes, you know, the regulators that we have now, and it kind of, in some ways, reimagines how regulation would work. But does it really do anything if regulators aren't regulating or if they're not doing their job? I mean, obviously, as Harry Markopoulos did, like you said, he came to the SEC and had the Madoff case laid out for them, and they never did anything. Mm-hmm. And I think questions with this bill are, so what if we give new power to, you know, ABC regulators? They didn't do their job in the past. What guarantee is there that they'll do it now? And you know, it's a really good question. I think some of the things you can do are you can essentially dummy-proof financial reform, which is you make rules that don't involve regulators. You know, you want to limit risky gambling on Wall Street, well, then you can put caps on that. Or you can, you know, demand that banks hold certain amounts of money as reserves in case they have big losses. And those are things that I think are good. But in a big way, the bill just relies on the same people to, you know, prevent too big to fail after the crisis, who are the ones who missed it before. And that's definitely a problem.
Okay, Al.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call. Gail, you're on the air with Andy Kroll of Mother Jones.
Hello.
Hi, Gail.
Hi. You know, the things that Andy's been talking about, I think a lot of this problem would be solved if Glass-Steagall was reenacted. And, you know, I think that's really at the crux of the problem. Also, I wanted to ask if by any chance he saw Bill Moyers last night. He had two guys on that wrote the book 13 Bankers. And I've heard other economists say this, too, that if these banks are not broken up and made, you know, so they were, they could not fail, you know, broken up, you know, too big to fail, that it's going to happen again because they're just going on their merry way. It's going to happen again, just like at the beginning of 2008. And one of the guys was named Quack, I think, and there was another.
Easy to remember.
Yeah. It was an incredible show. And also, I would like to see the Elizabeth Warren take control of, you know, just like she's been oversight of the TARP Commission. I think she is a brilliant woman. I think she would be an excellent head of to oversee this committee. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call, Gail, and thanks for listening. Andy, what about the Glass-Steagall Act? Is that sort of besides the point at this juncture?
Well, there's part of the bill, the Senate bill right now, is something that has been dubbed the Volcker Rule.
Mm-hmm.
It's been named after Paul Volcker, a former Federal Reserve Chairman. And that the Volcker Rule kind of sort of gets at what Glass-Steagall was about. I mean, you know, Glass-Steagall was a way of walling off the, you know, more risky speculative investment banking from, you know, the more traditional, boring commercial bank. And there have been a lot of calls. There's even been a bill that, believe it or not, John McCain supported in the Senate to reenact Glass-Steagall. And, you know, I think Gail's comment about the Volcker Rule, I should say, the Volcker Rule would try to ban what's called proprietary trading, and that's when a bank trades for its own purposes, not for a client. And proprietary trading was something that was definitely came into play with the crisis, and I think the Volcker Rule would try to get at that. You know, it would wall off, you know, certain risky investing from commercial banking. I don't think it would be nearly as tough, especially as it looks in the bill right now, it would nearly restore Glass-Steagall, you know, the way that Gail mentions. And you know, I think Gail's comment about the Moyers show, which I did see, which I agree was great, and Simon Johnson is the one economist and James Kwok is the other, and their book is really good as well. You know, it's the issue of, you know, of just making, of eliminating banks that grow as big as, you know, a Citigroup or a Bank of America.
Andy, what's the relationship between the Glass-Steagall, for instance? What I noticed after my first mortgage was, you know, how many pints of blood could I give them and how many hoops could I jump through and everything but my firstborn. And then the next time I went for a loan, it was the same bank, but things had changed a little bit. But the third time, my third mortgage was the charm. You know, that was when Countrywide was in play by then. What changed to make it so easy to get credit like that? And what did the Glass-Steagall Act have to do with that?
Well, the ease with which you got credit was a combination of many things. The main one is just the decline, at least in very recent history, the decline of underwriting standards, you know, what you have to do to get this loan. You know, the Federal Reserve had a policy of low interest rates, which means lots of easy money, and mortgage companies were more than willing to write and issue tons of mortgages when money was so easy. And thus, you know, when they do that, they start caring less and less about the qualifications of the people that they're giving credit.
And there was nothing in law, etched in law, to, you know, the standards were just standards. They weren't.
Right. The standards were standards. Okay. I mean, there is a framework saying what, well, no, there actually isn't. Yeah, I mean, it really is just guidelines and standards and suggestions. And the Federal Reserve over a period of, you know, a decade, had many what it calls guidances, which it would send a note to its banks and say, hey, you know, we're not going to tell you to do anything, but how about you get a little bit better about your mortgage lending. And of course, the banks don't care about that when the money is good.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, so the Fed, you know, its hands-off approach definitely plays into
the mortgage crisis. Now, Glass-Steagall is a little bit different from how easy it became to get a mortgage, and just the huge explosion of subprime mortgages and especially bad subprime mortgages, toxic loans. Mm-hmm. But it's one of those problems that's at the root of what we're trying to fix, of what lawmakers, of what bureaucrats, all of the above are trying to fix, and that's just there's an inherent danger when you have a huge financial entity that's both an investment bank and it sponsors hedge funds and it takes loans from or takes deposits from consumers and it makes loans back to them, and you just grow these behemoths. And this is what Simon Johnson and James Kwok are saying. The financial system should not have these supermarket, the Walmart of banks.
Mm-hmm.
They need to be broken up. They need to be smaller, and more dispersed across, the financial markets and the economy, because it's unhealthy and it's, just incredibly unsafe and unstable when you let one entity, say like Citigroup, when you let them grow so big, there is a serious problem there.
Let's take another phone call if you want to. We have a few more minutes left, about eight more minutes. 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Kevin, you're on the air with Andy Kroll of Mother Jones. Welcome to the show.
Hey, well, thank you. You might have already talked about this, but just after that last comment, that the top 2%, that you hear everybody talking about, that's the wealthiest of the nation. I guess what I'm trying to say is, what about this issue of money making money, and not making anything productive? How does that play at the core of this issue and the Obama's next attempt to help bring in some financial reform? I guess what I'm saying is this: I've heard an alternative, like in some Muslim countries, or Sharia law, where money's not allowed to make money; it has to make something that's productive. Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Could they control that in the good old United States, Andy?
Well, I mean, definitely not with the way Sharia law. I don't think that would work. the Congress had a good point. I mean, I think Floyd Norris, a columnist for the New York Times, called it the financialization of America, which is basically, so many of the brightest minds, people coming out of college, people with the master's degrees, instead of going to, auto manufacturers or GE or going places where people actually do make things, they went to Wall Street, and they may make financial products, but it's gotten to the point of, what societal good is there in a credit default swap? All this rocketry that you see on Wall Street, it serves a purpose for them, which is to make more money off of their money. but it doesn't really serve a broader good. And I think that's a question that people are starting to look at again now, saying, what if all these incredibly talented, smart people were, working as engineers, or were, developing alternative energy sources or something with a little more of a tangible benefit than new ways to make more money.
Can I ask one more quick question?
Sure, Kevin, real quick.
In other countries like France or England, is this same, what Michael Moore had in his movie, the one guy said that, and the difference is in those countries, the government's scared of the people, and in this country, the people are scared of the government. Is this same thing happening over there? Are the people like saying, hey, you better not ever try this crap again, or somebody's going to get a tarred and feathered in the town square? Thanks for the show. Great show.
Yep. Thanks, Kevin.
I don't know. I don't think that's the case here, unfortunately. I'm not going to judge the benefit or the detriment of that, but I think the problem with the government is, speaking of Simon Johnson, who Gail mentioned, there's this corridor or revolving door between Washington and Wall Street. And in many ways, the interests of Wall Street have kind of co-opted the interests of or the actions of Washington, and there's just a very, very close link there, And I think that, you know, many people have raised that as a potential problem, that, you know, so many alums of Goldman Sachs and Citi and the others work, you know, in the Treasury and so on. So I don't think that there is that same sense that Kevin mentioned abroad that there is in the U.S.
Okay, we have another call, 614-292-8513. We have just a few more minutes. And Glenn, you're on the air. You want to talk about the idea that Congress forced banks to make these risky loans. Do you think it's exaggerated?
Welcome. Yes. Apparently a law was passed, I think, like 20 years ago, maybe during the first Bush administration, that encouraged banks to provide loans to low-income people. And that this worked fine for roughly 14 or 15 years. And all of a sudden, according to more conservative commenters, that was the cause of this entire subprime mortgage problem. It sounds like there's like a little grain of truth there, but they've put everything on that one law from way back.
I thought that was during whatever they loosened the requirements was during the Clinton administration.
Was it Clinton?
About 15 years ago, but I don't know. Andy's the expert.
No, yeah, it was during the Clinton administration mostly, and that's where you saw it was especially channeled through the twin housing companies, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
That's right.
Which everyone knows, and they were basic. Those two companies were basically used as a way to push, you know, the federal government's line that, you know, homeownership is like apple pie. You know, it needs to be for everybody. And yeah, I think that just like this, you can't pin the roots of the financial crisis on anything. But I mean, I think the claim that has something to do with it. Yeah, sure. There's a grain of truth there, no doubt. That accelerated the deterioration of lending standards, but I think greed probably has just as much to do with it as well, that mortgage companies saw these as people who were going to spend money and take out mortgages, and we might as well go after them as well. So it's a grain of salt is a good way, a grain of truth is a good way to put it, but it's definitely by no means the root cause or the singular driving force.
Yeah, it worked so well for so long before all of a sudden it blew up. Seemed like just a little more regulation would have prevented that.
Glenn, thanks for your call.
Sure.
We have just about run out of time. I want to thank my guest, Andy Kroll. He is an investigative reporter for Mother Jones Magazine, covers Congress, and we were talking about financial regulation reform. Andy, thanks a lot for joining us today. We didn't get to everything, but it was very helpful.
Thank you.
Okay. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.